This week on the show, when the Power Macintosh ran netware is what we're covering as a headline story, You Are Not Too Late, which is another interesting article by none other than Kevin Kelly. OpenZFS 2.2.3 has been out, and Tom Jones has been blogging about NetMap running on CXGBE interfaces and how to make that much faster. A recent abrupt change in Internet SSH brute force attacks, some OpenBSD features that aren't widely known is what we're covering, as well as release notes for OmniOS version 11, the making of the RPi 2040 Doom, and more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 550, NetWare and NetMap, recorded on the 6th of March 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDNow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDNow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hello, I'm your host, Benedikt Reuschling. Yes, that's you. You froze there for a minute, but hopefully catching up later. Hello, everyone. It will be done in post. No one will hear about this.
It's been a very chaotic week. There's a lot of chaos. My audio sounds this way because while I'm moving house, while I kept out the microphone to record audio with, I didn't keep out any of the adapters to mount it to a stand or an arm. So I can see three things to put a microphone on. I don't have any way to attach it.
We just call it chaos now, and everyone will be fine. And we have news roundup and headlines this week. Let's go. With headlines this week, those start when the Power Macintosh ran netware featuring Wormhole and Cyberpunk. That's a lot to digest. So let's see. JT, our producer, is... as probably many of you know, an old vintage computer collector, geek, and overall, connoisseur of old hardware. And this one goes right into this category. So this is from oldvcr.blogspot.com. And when the Power Macintosh ran netware featuring Wormhole and Cyberpunk is the title. And the subtitle, or the little disclaimer at the bottom, if it is one, says this entry and the software will demonstrate is in large part thanks to an anonymous Apple developer who was part of the NetWare team. Thank you. Okay, so here we go. Novell NetWare, the network operating system of the 1990s. Nothing was quite like it, luckily, until Windows NT muscled it on its action near the end of the decade. If you were sharing lots of files between lots of PCs, NetWare was in there somewhere. My earliest memory of NetWare was stealing or liberating a copy of Born and Turbo Pascal from a campus NetWare 3.x server around 1993, 1994, which, because God had a sense of humor, was later the university I ended up working for. Nice. Why, the very mention of NetWare almost certainly caused those of you familiar with it to get an instant mental image of monitor.nlm. Like the one shown in the picture that we can't, of course, show you. You have to look at the show notes here to get to the blog post itself and see the old vintage computer screens. But you can probably imagine if you've been around long enough to remember. But Novell wanted NetWare servers to be more than just PCs and the PC ecosystem to be more than just Microsoft. And in an attempt to gain footholds elsewhere, the company accumulated some strange bedfellows. HP, Sun, and Data General were on board, and IBM did so in grander form. But surely the most unexpected company Novell tried to court was, drumroll, Apple. Yes, that screenshot is a real Power Macintosh 6100, actually a Performa 6116 CD, in the FlutGap lab running exactly what you think it's running. As a matter of fact, that Apple logo superimposed on the 19th Novell teeth. They led off with what was a real resource image that came from it. No, the author here didn't mean Macintoshes accessing NetWare servers as clients. We mean Macs as NetWare servers themselves. As proof, we'll take an entire tour of Power Macintosh NetWare on this 6116 CD and try to boot it on the on the Apple network server, its actual intended target. NetWare on the Mac really existed as part of the same bizarro universe that ported the Macintosh Finder to Novell DR-DOS, meaning it's time for yet another weird Apple story during Apple's weirdest days. That's where the cyberpunk comes into it, because that's what the logo here says. Huh. Looks like an advertisement poster or something. For as associated with PCs and DOS as NetWare ended up being, the first version of what would become NetWare didn't even run on x86. Novell was originally founded as Novell Data Systems Incorporated in Orem, Utah in 1980. They initially sold their own Z80-based CP/M hardware, which wasn't very lucrative as market competition grew, and as a means of distinguishing their offerings, Novell management hit on the idea of networking the machines together. For this work, the company contracted with Superset Software in 1981, founded by a group of Brigham Young University alumni, notably Drew Major, who went on to become Novell's chief scientist. They developed S-Net, short for ShareNet, a Motorola's 86,000-based server running CP/M86K, able to share data between CP/M clients. As CP/M market share started to shrink, S-Net was retrofitted to allow it to also serve MS-DOS PC clients and became the first version of NetWare in 1983. Let's go to the next section. This box shown in the picture that you don't see was actually 68B server hardware Novell sold in the mid-1980s. In early network clients, nodes were connected in a star arrangement, moving to more complex topologies as networks increased in size, but primarily communication with the server, both them and later, was via the Network Core Protocol, or NCP. Those nodes that were directly wired to an S-box communicated via RS-422, but larger networks transported NCP over the IPX and SPX protocols derived from Xerox network systems IDP and SPP, which are roughly analogous to IP and TCP. So, a little bit further down, to broaden the market further, Novell ported NetWare away from their custom 68K hardware to 8086 PCs in 1984, becoming NetWare 86. And then advanced NetWare 68 and 86 in 1985, which could support more than one server. The PC versions employed a custom NetWare file system format for NetWare partitions that allowed larger capacities and faster access than DOS FAT. Okay. So let's skip a little bit ahead because we want to hear more about the Apple deal. Let's see where this starts here. Here, in 1992, Apple announced its own deal with Novell. Not only would Macintosh users get full access to NetWare services, but the Macintosh Finder would become the front end for NetWare and Novell's DR-DOS. From Novell's recent acquisition of Digital Research, a nice bit of symmetry with NetWare's CP/M origins, despite Apple using Digital Research in 1985 for GM ripping off the Mac. Apple also planned to port Apple Events, QuickDraw, GX, and other key libraries to DR-DOS, yielding a hybrid Mac-on-DOS system that both companies believed would enable them to jointly take on Microsoft. And this was the Star Trek project. You read correctly. This is the Star Trek project, going where no Mac had gone before to Intel, and was even quietly supported by Intel themselves, which provided 486 systems for the porting work. The prototype came together in just over 3 months, including its own functional port of QuickTime, but PC manufacturers were uninterested due to their restrictive royalty terms with Microsoft, and industry figures openly derided it. Bill Gates himself called it, quote, lipstick on a chicken, unquote. The project was controversial internally as well, and after Scully's departure, incoming CEO Michael Spindler killed it in 1993 as a potential threat to the upcoming PowerPC transition. Okay. There's a couple of sections in between where more history is given.
This episode of BSD Now is made possible because of you. We appreciate your willingness to support BSD Now.
The cyberpunk part of it is the following. Cyberpunk got as far as actual CDs being pressed for it. And this one of them, as provided by our anonymous Apple developer, marked Apple registered confidential, so they've blacked out the hard-inked CD number, even though it almost certainly doesn't mean anything anymore. Despite the label reading .0, one. Yeah. The disk actually contains a demo dated July 20, 1994, revision 5. And the disk itself is dated from August 1994, based on the etching on the inner ring. It contains a bootable Mac OS 7.1.2 first version of System 7 to support Power Macs, a disk utility for cloning and partitioning, a disk image for installation, the bootloader, the NetWare kernel documentation, and other sundry utilities and client tools. We'll look into more into the CD contents later. So that's a whole long article. Of course, we can't read it in full, but there's definitely a lot of pictures from how the system looks. They booted it and got it to work. And you can kind of explore this historic piece, which never saw the light of day, at least in a wider sense. And oh dear, that would have been a whole big thing if NetWare got it to the place where it originally was intended.
Yeah, it was great.
So, yeah, article. I think
it's very long.
Things you never knew would have existed, but sometimes it's better this way.
And it features a picture of someone wearing a very large top hat. Iguana Power Surgius, referring to Power Surge, the codename for the PCI project, and Herman, a live iguana who lived with engineer Dave Evans. It's well worth picking up and reading all the way through it. Just seeing the cyberpunk logo is definitely worth it. The next up, next up, we have a blog post coming from deep in the past, but it had a resurgence on Hacker News this week, but I realized that it's now 2024. So this article was written in 2014. Oh, I should have more.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Yeah, so this was written in 2014 in August. It comes from Kevin Kelly at kk.org, one of the internet fathers, I would say. And Kevin wrote... Yeah. Writes, can you imagine how awesome it would have been to be an entrepreneur in 1985 when almost any .com name you wanted was available? All words, short ones, cool ones, all you had to do was ask for the one you wanted. It didn't even cost anything to claim. The grand opportunity was true for years. And in 1994, a Wired writer noticed that McDonald's.com was still unclaimed. So with our encouragement, he registered it and tried to give it to McDonald's. But their cluelessness about the internet was so hilarious, it became a Wired story. Shortly before that, I noticed that ABC.com was not claimed, so I gave a consulting presentation to the top floor ABC executives about the future of digital. I told them that they should get their smartest geek down in the basement to register their domain name. They didn't. The internet was a wide open frontier then. It was easy to be in the first category in X. Consumers had few expectations and the barriers were extremely low. Start a search engine, an online store, serve up amateur video. Of course, that was then. Looking back now, it seems as waves of settlers have since bulldozed and developed every possible venue, leaving only the most difficult and gnarly specs for today's newcomers. 30 years later, the internet feels saturated, bloated, overstuffed with apps, platforms, devices, and more than enough content to demand your attention for the next million years. Even if you could manage to squeeze in another tiny innovation, who would notice? Yet, if we consider what we have gained in the last 30 years, this abundance smells almost miraculous. We got instant connection with our friends and family anywhere, a customizable stream of news wherever we want it, zoomable 3D maps of most cities of the world, an encyclopedia we can query with spoken words, movies we can watch on a flat slab in our pocket, a virtual everything store that delivered the next day, to name only six out of thousands that could be mentioned. But here is the thing. In terms of the internet, nothing has happened yet. The internet is still the beginning of its beginning. If we could climb into a time machine and journey 30 years into the future, and from that vantage point look back today, we'd realize that most of the greatest products running the lives of citizens in 2044 were not invented until after 2014. People in the future will look at their holodecks, their wearable virtual reality contact lenses and downloadable avatars and AI interfaces and say, you didn't really have the internet or whatever they call it then, back then. And they'd be right, because from our perspective, the greatest online things in the first half of this century are all before us. All these miraculous inventions are waiting for that crazy, no one told me it was impossible visionary to start grabbing the low-hanging fruit. The equivalent of .com names of 1984. Because here is the other thing that graybeards in 2044 will tell you. can you imagine how awesome it would have been to be an entrepreneur in 2014? It was wide open frontier. You could pick almost any category X and add some AI to it, put it in the cloud. Few devices had more than one or two sensors in them, unlike the hundreds now. Expectations and barriers were low. It was easy to be the first, and they would sigh, "Oh, if only we realized how possible everything was back then." So the truth, right now, today, in 2014, not today, is the best time to start something on the internet. There has never been a better time in the whole history of the world to invent something. There's never been a better time with more opportunities, more openings, lower barriers, higher benefit risk ratios, better returns, greater upsides than now, right now, this minute. That minute. This is the time that folks in the future will look back and say, "Oh, to have been alive back then." The last 30 years has created a marvelous starting point, a solid platform to build truly great things. However, the coolest stuff has not yet been invented. All this new greatness will not be more of the same that exists today. It will not merely be better, it will be different beyond another. But you knew that. What you may not have realized is that today truly is a wide open frontier. It is the best time ever in human history to begin. You are not late.
Oh, it's interesting looking back, like from now, how that came true or was kind of a visionary thing. And in 10 years, we look at back this one and we'll think, how stupid and naive they were back then.
Yeah, BSD now, but, yeah. 800.
Oh, yeah. Or 8,000, whatever.
That's not how numbers work, Benedict.
Hopefully our listeners will still be there with us. We'll all be a bit older and wiser by then. But until then, we'll stick around. And we have news roundup with you and with us around NetMap on CXGBE interfaces by none other than a certain Tom Jones, not the singer. So keep blogging, always do that. And this one is about the CXGBE interfaces with NetMap. So Tom writes, last year his testbed machine got the luxury of 100 gigabit Celsius T6 network interfaces with a pair of T62-100 LPCR cards. He has been using these recently for VPP development on FreeBSD. There's a separate link to that one. And while they work well, he has been having a lot of trouble doing any packet generation with them. So he got pretty miserable performance using NetMap's packet gen tool on FreeBSD and trying Linux. The comparative old oddness of the T6 driver seems to trip the T-Rex packet generator suit on Linux. Nice name for a packet generator. From reading Celsius' own documentation, it seemed he was missing something. They have benchmarks using packet gen showing link saturation for small packets at 40 gigabits per second on their T5 cards. What was up? So when Tom ran a packet gen that lives in tools/tools/netmap benchmark, he gets a little under 1 gigabit per second of traffic. Here's a little bit of a screenshot from the terminal or, you know, what kind of parameters he ran. And 9 million packets per second, that is, right?
Yeah.
MPPS? Yeah. 9 million packets per second, isn't that great? And since he paid for 100 gigabit and 4 just isn't enough. FreeBSD is a zero-copy user space networking framework called NetMap. It cleverly hooks into drivers early in their packet processing pipeline, and if there is a NetMap application running, steals them so the host doesn't see them. Aiding with support, if the app doesn't want the given packet, it can be given back to the driver and normal processing can occur. Drivers can be natively supported with NetMap, or if support isn't available, then an emulated mode driver can be used. Eventually, after looking really, really hard at the Chelsea example, Tom saw that the network interface names were different from mine or from his. They were prefixed with a V, VCXL rather than CXL. A bunch of Googling later, he read the top CXGBE man page correctly, which says the CXGBE driver uses different names for devices based on the associated ASIC. Okay, that's where the names come from. So to get a virtual interface, we needed to set the hwcxgbe.num_vis sysctl to a value greater than 1. Then he added the following to his bootloader conf, which is hwcxgbe.num_vis=2, and some other sections. So those were set to 8, this with the number of netmap RX TX queues, as well as the per VI. So these set on a reboot, we have a shiny new VCC0 device letting packet gen run there. He gets much nicer results. So that's now 70 million packets per second. Wow. And 33 gigabits per second of 64-byte packets is pretty great. With an iMix, he can saturate the 700 gigabits per second with the packet gen tool. He didn't find anything about this differentiator by searching packet gen, since it doesn't mention it. There are some D-message lines, but if you don't know, you don't know. Okay, so people should be aware of these options, otherwise they will complain about NetMap not being as fast as advertised.
I think the word NetMap should be in some of these NetMap pages, but I'm not sure where to put it. But now I know this, it's never going to happen again, so it's fine.
Yeah, it's good to know, and that's good to make these experiments to show that NetMap is still being... Is it still under development, or is it kind of stalled, or is someone working on it? Because it's available and people can use it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's actively working on it, but I know Vincenzo will still work on patches because he did some stuff last year with Mark Johnson. Someone told me that the Linux version was never accepted, so that probably hampered things a bit. And I don't know the state of the Windows port, but...
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, you can get 100 gigabit out of it quite easily. It's not using all of a computer, which is quite a lot of traffic to be generating. I don't know. I'll see, because I need to use it for other stuff. So maybe there are some things to fix. It's not...
There will be more. Okay.
Great. It's very difficult to use. Okay, next up we have, I assume, the next OpenZFS release, ZFS 2.2.3, 2 weeks ago, so quite recent. And these are release notes, so I don't really know what to highlight here. I'll highlight some random stuff, and if you want to know more, you can go look at our show notes and find the release notes. Supported platforms, Linux compatible with 3.10 to 6.7 kernels. Damn, that must be a nightmare to maintain. And FreeBSD compatible releases starting from 12.2 release, so that's all of the currently supported releases FreeBSD. Changes. Add NTFY, Nifty, notification support to Zed, so you can get your notifications via pushover. That's cool. ZFS list add the -TFS and -TVol options. Lua, backport a CVE fix. Fix the FreeBSD user space build. Very funny thing to have in the show notes. Bunch of compat things in Linux 6.8 and 6.7. Fixes around asserts, fixes around running Linux MuSol on FreeBSD, fixes out of memory. This is quite a minor release, but there's a ton of changes in here. I can tell you how many there were if I had checked beforehand. That's
block
cool.
Cloning always, tests?
Yeah, and they do a lot of testing.
Yeah, especially since that feature got a little bit of a bumpy start. It's so good to have tests now for this.
Yeah. We're going to roll into the next one because that was very small.
Yeah.
So next up we have Chris Siebenman continuing to blog. And this time Chris is writing about a recent abrupt change in internet SSH brute force attacks against us. Chris writes, it's general wisdom in the sysadmin community that if you expose a SSH port to the internet, people will show up and poke at it. And by people, I mean attackers that are probably mostly automated. For several years, the pattern to this I've noticed was an apparent combination of two activities. There was a constant background pitter-patter of various IPs, each making a probe once a minute or less, but for tens of minutes or longer. And then periodic bursts where a single IP would be more active, sometimes significantly so. Although I can't be sure, I think the rate of both the background probes and the periodic bursts was significantly up compared to how it was a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, making a direct comparison is difficult due to Grafana Loki issues. Then there came this past Tuesday, and I noticed and reported on the Fediverse. This is our system administrator's what is wrong face when the internet SSH authentication probes against our systems seem to have fallen off a cliff, as reported by system logs. We shouldn't be seeing only two in the last hour. The nosedive seems to have started at 6:30 Eastern and hit basically nothing by 9:30 a.m. After looking at this longer, the pattern I'm now seeing on our systems is basically that the background low-volume probes seem to have gone away. Every so often, some attacker will fire up a serious bulk probe, making, for example, 400 attempts over a half an hour, often a random assortment of non-existent logins. And rarely there will be a burst where a dozen IPs will each make an attempt or two, then stop. There's some signs that a lot of IPs are Tor exit nodes, but for a lot of the time, there's nothing. We can go an hour or three with absolutely no probes at all, which never used to happen. Previously, a typical baseline of probes was around 100 an hour. Since the higher rate SSH probes get through fine, this doesn't seem to be anything in our firewalls or local configurations. I initially wondered about things like a change in logging that came with Ubuntu package upgrade. Instead, it seems to be a change in attacker behavior, and since it took about 2 hours to take full effect on Tuesday morning, I wonder if it was something getting progressively shut down or reoriented. Cool.
Yeah, interesting how these shift to other targets or...
Maybe someone tidied up all the bad actors on the internet.
That would be great. Like, that would be really good. Couple of law enforcement actions could go a long way. Okay. Here, the next item has us another article from Celine about, you know, some of the OpenBSD features that aren't widely known. And she writes, in this blog post, you will learn about OpenBSD features that can be useful, but not widespread. They often have a niche usage, and also nice usage as well. But it's important to know they exist to prevent you from reinventing the wheel. So she links, of course, to the OpenBSD website, which everyone has probably set as their homepage by now. So all fine. Features. The following list of features are not all OpenBSD specific, as some can be found on other BSD systems. Most of the knowledge will not be useful to Linux users. And I have to say, each time I start on the Ubuntu boxes at the university and I see starting the OpenBSD SSH server, I'm kind of like, yep, see, that's where OpenBSD is also. Okay, go back to the article. And the secure level, for example, she lists, the secure level is a sysctl named kern.secure level. It has four different values from level minus one to level two, and it's only possible to increase the level. By default, the system enters secure level one when in multi-user mode, the default when booting a regular installation. It's then possible to escalate to the last secure level, which is two, which will enable the following extra security. All raw disks are read-only, so it's not possible to try to make a change to the storage devices. The time is almost lock. It's only possible to modify the clock slowly by small steps, maybe 1 second max every so often. And the firewall PF rules can't be modified, flushed, or altered. This feature is mostly useful for dedicated firewall with rules that rarely change. Preventing the time to change is really useful for remote logging, as it allows being sure of when things happen, and you can be assured the past locks weren't modified. Security level of one already enables some extra security, like immutable and append-only file flags. These can't be removed. And these overlook flags that can be applied with change flags can lock down files to prevent anyone from modifying them. The append-only flag is really useful for locks because you can't modify the content, but this doesn't prevent adding new content. History can't be modified this way. She links to the appropriate man pages for secure level and change flags if you want to learn more. And this feature exists in other BSD systems, she notes. Then we have the memory allocator extra checks. OpenBSD's memory allocator can be tweaked system-wide or per command to add extra checks. This could be either used for security reasons or to look for memory allocation-related bugs in a program. This is very common. There are two methods to apply the changes. System-wide, by using the sysctl vm.malloc_conf, either immediately with the sysctl command or at boot in etc sysctl.conf. Make sure you quote the value here and some characters such as greater than will create troubles, otherwise been there, done that. On the command line is the other one, by prepending env and then in capital malloc_options equals flags is lowercase again, program to run, and that will then, you know, apply only to this program. The man page gives a full list of flags to use as options. The easiest to use capital S for security checks. It is stated in the man page that a program misbehaving with any flag other than X is buggy, so it's not your fault if you use malloc options and the program is crashing. She links also to the relevant man pages there. Then she lists file flags. You are certainly used to files attributes like permissions or ownership, but on many file systems, including OpenBSD's FFS, there are flags as well. The file flags can be altered with the command change flags, ch flags. There are a couple of flags available. No dump. Prevent the files from being saved by the command dump, except if you use a flag and dump it to bypass this. Then we have sappnd. The file can only be used in writing, append mode. Only root can set or remove this flag. Then we have schg. The file cannot be changed. It becomes immutable. Only root can alter this flag. And uappnd. You guessed it, same as sappnd mode, but the user can alter the flag. And uchg, same as schg mode, but the user can alter the flag. As explained in the secure level section, in the second level, or the default secure level 1, the flag sappnd and schg can't be removed. You would need to reboot in single user mode to remove these flags. Okay. Now the next one, crontab has some extra parameters in OpenBSD. Over the last couple of years, it got these additions. Random, for example, random number for time fields. You can use tilde in a field instead of a number or a star to generate a random value that will remain stable until the crontab is reloaded. Things like tilde slash 5 work. You can force the random value within a range with 20 tilde 40, like this, to get values between 20 and 40. Oh, that's useful. Only send an email if the return code isn't 0 for the cron job at dash n between the time and the command, like in something something star 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 minus n slash bin something. Only run one instance of a job at a time at minus lowercase s between the time and the command, like in star 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 minus s and then some command. This is incredibly useful for cron jobs that shouldn't be running twice in parallel. If the job duration is longer than usual, you are ensured it will never start a new instance between the previous one and this current one. And now logging, add minus q between the time and the command to quiet this thing, I guess. The effect will be that this cron job will not be logged in var cron slash log. It's possible to use a combination of flags, of course, like n and s. The random time is useful when you have multiple systems and you don't want them to run all a command at the same time, like in the case they would trigger a huge I/O on the remote server. She also lists auto-installing media. One cool feature of OpenBSD is the ability to easily create an installation media with pre-configured answers. This is done by injecting a specific file in the bsd.rd install kernel. There's a simple tool named upOpenBSD that was created by Semariet to easily modify such BSDRD files to include the auto-install file, and she forked the project to continue its maintenance. In addition to automatically installing OpenBSD with users, SSH configuration, sets to install, etc., it's also possible to add a site.tgz archive along with the usual sets archive that includes files you want to add to the system. This can include a script to run at first boot to trigger some automation. These features are a must-have if you run OpenBSD in production and you have many of them to manage, and crawling a new device to the fleet should be automated as possible. Oh, yes. She also lists APMD daemon hooks, as well as hotplugd for hooks on devices events, and alt root and talk for a local chat in a terminal. But I leave you with these and only do the conclusion here. There are interesting features of MSD that she wanted to highlight a bit, and she did. Maybe you will find them useful. If you know cool features that could be added to this list, please reach out to her and check out the full article for the bits that I didn't read out, because these are definitely good to know about.
Cool. Next up, we have a look into the OmniOS current release notes. I don't actually know how the name branches. These are the release notes for OmniOS v11 R151048. Which smells a lot of SVN. R151048O, weekly release for the week commencing the 12th of February, 2024. This update requires a reboot, which is pretty cool. Security fixes updated for curl to 8.6.0, fixing CVE-2024-0853. libxml2 updated to version 211.7, fixing a different CVE. And some other changes. The ENA network driver has received a number of fixes that make it more stable in recent AWS EC2 instant types. Some improvements to PCI enumeration under BIOS boot as AWS EC2 guests have been integrated. Time zone data has been updated to version 2024A. Ah, catching Kazakhstan. Yeah, and they have weekly releases going back for a while, which is actually really cool. Though, maybe we're missing one. FreeBSD for a long time did weekly snapshots. Like, they would spin up a snapshot build on a Thursday, and we would get snapshots 30 hours later once they propagated around the world. It would have been really fascinating to have release notes for each of these. I mean, I understand it's a lot more work, and there's a lot of stuff happening every week, but it would make compiling the release notes easier if you had done it every single week for the last however long.
Yeah, it's not a huge chunk at the end, only incremental ones.
I do think there's an article.
Okay, next right. article yeah. has the making of. Is it?
Yeah, no, go. It's fine. Go. You could, I was going to speculate.
Okay. Yeah, what's going on there? So this one has RP2040 Doom, the making of.
By a dirty table. Like the problem with macro photography is that you can see all of the dirt. The problem with taking photos of anything at all is you see all of the dirt everywhere.
Oh, you see. Yeah, which picture
at,
are you
looking at? If you look at the picture of the Raspberry Pis, there's like all these scratches on the table. And
ah, exactly.
Yeah. And that's just life, right? Like, that's how things are. I watched a video about like why you should not be a cooking YouTuber. And it was just like, your kitchen is not clean enough. Like, no matter how clean it is, people will watch the video and be like, what a disgusting kitchen. Be like,
but yeah, they see all see the it. Specs.
Yeah, dirt. You see it.
Like, yeah.
I think because it almost
depends
blends
on the
in.
Camera they're using.
That's why I always take photos like this on a wooden table. But even now I'm like, ah, you can see all this dirt on the table. I'm like, it wipes down,
but come
it's still
on.
There.
This is not a clean room environment.
I was weighing the computer, which eventually killed my framework laptop, and I got the kitchen scales because they're the kitchen scales, and I took a photo, but I cleaned the scales first. I was like, you're going to be able to see that I just cleaned the scales in this picture. It's going to be really obvious. Maybe not. Anyway, sorry, please continue with this article.
Oh, yes, please. So this is a challenge to run. Well, the challenge goes, given a new platform, it's only natural to think of porting Doom to it, because why not? With 264K of RAM, two Cortex M0 Plus CPUs, and a decent clock speed, the RP2040 is certainly not the tightest platform Doom has ever been ported to. Although at less than $1, it's probably one of the cheapest. So they wanted to set themselves a more aggressive set of goals. So everything should match the original game experience. All the graphics at classic 320x200 resolution, stereo sound effect, OPL2 music, save and load, demo playback, cheats, networking. Cheats have to work, of course. Network multiplayer. Basically, it should feel like the original game. It should run on the Raspberry Pi Pico. This really tightens up a lot, as there is only 2 megabytes of flash for all the code and data. Nevertheless, they decided that all 9 levels of the shareware Doom 1.wad should be playable on the Pico in a single binary. There was to be no sneaky discarding of splash screens, altering of levels, downsampling of textures, or whatever. RP2040 boards with 8 megabytes should be able to play at least the full Ultimate Doom and Doom 2 WADs. Okay, third, RP2040 should output directly to VGA with 16 color pins for RGB565 along with the H-Sync and V-Sync, along with stereo sound. Note that the RP2040 itself doesn't have any video or audio hardware. Okay, however, its PIO, the programmable I.O. feature, can be used to generate a wide range of digital signals under software control. So they list some immediately fairly obvious problems. The shareware Doom 1 WAD is 4 megabytes big, so they need to be compressing that down to fit in the 2 megabyte space. Then the VGA output means they would either need to draw the display just ahead of the beam at 60 frames per second, or set aside a lot of the RAM for two 320x200x8-bit frame buffers for double buffering. And if they took away RAM for the frame buffers, then they should be back with less than 160K of RAM space, which is really, really tight. This means they could not just decompress levels to RAM before they run. Equally, they could not hope to decompress levels to flash either, since there would be even less space for the code or what. This means the game would have to work directly off of compressed data in flash at runtime. And number four, waiting to support the original demos or wanting to support the original demos means everything has to match exactly what the original game, as the demos are simply a sequence of input events and the slightest calculation or behavior difference can cause desync ending up, for example, with the player running into and shooting at walls. Okay. So they have a results video out on YouTube to see how that works, or that it actually works. And they list a couple features as well as some development sections that you can go into on your own. And yeah, I would say congratulations for that. It has no BSD content as far as I can tell, but it's definitely an engineering feat that should be mentioned. Wow.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks and creates them with your local private key. And this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. And Tarsnap has bug bounties, so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
So we get emails. Sometimes the emails are interesting, and sometimes the emails are from you. You, the listener.
You listeners.
Sent to feedback at bsdnow.tv. And the first piece of feedback we have this week is Brendan talking about log files. Hi, Benedict, Jason, Tom, and JT. BJTJT.
Yeah, there's a pattern.
Is there any advantage to compressing log files as part of log rotate if the log files are on a compressed ZFS dataset? Each of my jails where the logs are stored on a separate ZFS dataset with compression turned on. Thanks, Brendan. Do you know Bendit?
Yes. Go to your newsyslog.conf and remove all the J's there, which means these are for the compression bits, because ZFS compresses better than those other algorithms. And then you restart the new syslog daemon and the new syslog service. And then from there on, your logs will be uncompressed. And the data set, if you look at the ref compress ratio on that, it will be just in the high 20s or high 30s even.
So it will compress better. So there is a benefit to not compressing them with log rotate.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Let ZFS take care of that. And you will have a lot more disk savings.
Why you ask these questions? Okay, next up we have advertisement from Misha. Hi, great people of BSD Now. Was hoping if
that
you
must
could
be
spend...
us.
Yeah, it might be us. I told them to send this email. I could have just announced this.
The other people.
Hi, great people of BSD Now. Was hoping if you could spend some time in one of the next episode shows to highlight the CFP for EuroBSDCon 2024 in Dublin, Ireland. The CFP will most likely open on the 1st of March, it did, and run until the 5th of May, it is continuing to. Any questions, please let me know. Thanks, Misha.
Excellent maneuver.
If you have questions about the EuroBSDCon CFP, do not email feedback at bsdnow.tv.
Yeah, no, that, no.
You will not get a timely answer. definitely won't get a timely answer. I will know the answer, but we won't know the answers. No one is involved. Completely separate people, apart from how we overlap. But if you want to advertise,
where will people find the CFP?
Yeah, if you go to eurobsdcon.org, it's linked from the main page, and then you can do stuff. And it's run through pre-talks this year, so it's not a nightmare to use.
We have bad connectivity.
It'll be great. Submit early, submit often. The more submissions you can come up with, the more submissions the content team will have to review, which involves me. So yeah, make my life harder. I don't mind.
That's a good problem to have.
MRE is like, I won't be at EuroBSD Con, but I still will pick talks I like. And I like hearing talks from people I've never met. And I like people's first exposures to things because it helps other people become exposed to stuff. And so if you have like a really, really technical talk that you want to give, perfect. We'd love to have it.
Or tutorial.
If you have something which is not so technical, something which is more about your experience using BSD and the journey you have taken through, like learning what things are, that's great too. One of the best talks I saw at EuroBSDCon was in Bucharest. I didn't see this. One of the best talks, concepts, I saw some of it in Bucharest, was a NetBSD developer, and she was talking about the lessons she learned getting started doing development on NetBSD. And I found it very interesting and inspirational, and it was a great talk. And it's, you know, the widest appeal because it's not very technical, but it also does a ton of value in the community. Also, if you just have crazy ideas, you should bring them too. I mean, the talks I've given at BSD conferences have been quite tame, but also I gave one about building a video streaming system for as cheap as possible at a conference where the talks were not recorded and that talk was not streamed. So it was great fun. It was delicious irony. But yeah, you should submit a talk. We're happy to review it. We'd love to have a great reject rate because that just means we get to pick the best talk. But we're very friendly. And if you have questions or want help with a proposal, just ask through the CFP system, not through feedback at bsdnow.tv. If you do send a submission to feedback at bsdnow.tv, we will read it and critique it live on air. So either that has now challenged you to sport or act as a warning. I'm not sure where it lands. Yeah, submit early, submit often.
So I plan on attending no matter whether I will be talking or not. And I have it on good authority that our co-host Jason is also trying to go there from the other side of the world. So that's good chance for you to meet up the BSD folks, at least 2/3 of them. And why not take this as an extra incentive to go?
If you count JT, that's...
Oh, right. How could I forget? He will blame on me this thing for years and years. Yeah, I'll put some ash on my bald head. So that will fix it again. Okay, so yeah, definitely check out EuroBSDCon. And I also would recommend that you check out BSDCan. They have not finished putting out a schedule yet, but they are in the final phase. So maybe conference.
They accepted talks today, the 6th of March, 2024. So there should be a schedule soon. Will you be in Canada, Benedict? So
I will.
Worth traveling. Meet Benedict.
Yeah. I can't be stopped. It's how long I've been going?
Can't be stopped.
Consecutive years? 13 years or something?
13 years.
It's, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
You just see how sorry my existence is going to be.
A lifetime of BSD cans. Like think about the the restaurant recommendations Benedict has just hidden in his head.
Yeah, just gelato. Oh, I'm the gelato king this year. I need to organize the gelato crawl. That's the thing Michael W. Lucas started. And yeah. Okay, I will organize something. Okay. Let's go to the last submission for our feedback and questions section, which is from Sebastiano about Zed, which we covered a couple episodes ago. And this is what he writes about. Hello, Ghost. In episode 547, you read an article about GNU Zed and you wondered what the differences are with BSD Zed. A few months ago, I looked into it because I wanted to write a blog post about Zed. Excellent. And found a couple of interesting ones beside a difference in the dash lowercase I option.
And
in place
there is
that you
also
mentioned.
Our little
first is escape sequences like backslash n for new lines,
Patreon,
and backslash t for tabs can be used in regular expressions in both
give
versions
a bit
of Zed.
Money
but
if
only
you'd like to support
GNU
this show,
Zed interprets them as special characters, also in the replacement part of an S command. For example, if you do echo a-b-c and pipe that to Z and let ZS replace the dashes with backslash Ns globally, all occurrences, that returns ABC, A space, B space, C. And on GNU set, on GNU set, but AN, BN, C on OpenBSD set, an escaped N is just a regular N, apparently. BSD said one has to use literal tabs or new lines. If working on an interactive shell, you can insert them by preceding them with Control V. The second difference is GNU set offers shortcuts for certain character sets and regular expressions, such as backslash B or word boundary, POSIX, crazy characters, or backslash S for white space, POSIX to space. The third difference is GNU set has some extra commands, and that is a separate link to the GNU website, the manual there. Okay. Overall, it looks like BSD set is more minimal, offering little more than what mandated by POSIX. And he'll leave it for you to decide if this is a good or a bad thing. Best regards, Sebastiano. Hey, thank you for this comparison.
Yeah, thank
that
you,
complements
Sebastiano.
The episode quite nicely.
I didn't.
He links to his own blog post, which we should totally mention. That's sebastiano.toronto.net. So if there's other BSD content there, we have more for future episodes to drag stuff out of. So keep blogging.
Yeah, I always thought it said couldn't insert new lines into the stream, but I guess you can. That's cool. It's nice to learn things.
Yeah.
I just use awk now.
I think I recently found a better, or if you call it better, better alternative to Zed, which is SD on GitHub. Just search and displace. And that doesn't need the forward slashes for the between the replacement characters. So you can just do SD quote backslash end quote and then the replacement character, like the comma, and you don't need the crazy number of forward slashes for it.
Search and displace GitHub. Is a great name for a tool.
Yeah, yeah.
There used and to be, I mean, it still exists. There used to be a tool called DriftNet, which you cannot Google for. Net. Did you mean different? No, I didn't.
Ah, okay. It trips up the search. And apparently SD is much faster, at least 2.35 size times, according to the benchmarks they made. I take that with a grain of salt, of course. And yeah, try it out. I think it's in the ports collection. If I'm not mistaken here, let's look at the long list of supported architectures. Yes, it's in FreeBSD ports version 1.00, which is the latest. Okay, yeah, so just as a side note, this is also available if you don't like the general set syntax. Okay, that is pretty much everything we have for you this week. Thank you for listening, as always. Keep blogging, keep going to conferences, keep sending us stuff to feedback at bsdnow.tv. People are also joining our BSD Now Telegram channel, which is t.me/bsdnow. And there is also our little space on the Patreons, patreon.com/bsdnow, where you can give a little bit of money if you like to support this show this way. Thank you. Any parting words from this episode?
No, I'm good. I'm going to have my dead computers.
Yeah, then till next week.